Rhode Island voters will decide the outcome of two primaries in the 1st Congressional District next Tuesday. The Democratic side of the race has gotten most of the attention since the district is heavily Democratic and the primary winner has a strong chance of coming out on top during the general election. The top contenders are former White House aide Gabe Amo, Pawtucket State Senator Sandra Cano, Lieutenant Governor Sabina Matos, and former State Representative Aaron Regenberg. The victor will square off in November against the winner of the Republican primary. With no public polling and the vote split among so many candidates, Tuesday's outcome is impossible to predict. I'm Ian Donis, and this week I'm going in-depth on the race in CD1 with two fellow political reporters, politics economics editor for WPRI-TV Channel 12, Ted Nisi, and statehouse reporter for the Providence Journal, Patrick Anderson. Ted, Patrick, thanks for joining me.
Good to be here, Ian.
Good to be here, Ian.
Let's start with our takeaways from the recent debates. Rival candidates have focused their criticism on Aaron Regenberg, indicating that he's the perceived frontrunner heading into the home stretch. Ted, my sense from your debate earlier this week on Channel 12 was that there was not really a huge blunder or a huge gain for any of the candidates and that the status quo is essentially prevailing in the race. Would you agree?
I think so, Ian. Yeah, I think the candidates, certainly the others, the non-Aarons, seemed happy that Regenberg had a tough moment off the top on the debt limit ceiling where he said, well, I'd only vote no as long as it didn't matter. And I'd vote yes if I was the deciding vote, which I just thought was an interesting moment. But I heard from people after the debate who don't necessarily like Regenberg, or at least aren't supporting him, who thought, you know, when you are the front runner, which everyone basically agrees at this point, and you are under coordinated assault by seven people on stage, he survived that and was still able to show over the course of the debate he knows the issues well, whether you agree with him or not. So, yeah, I don't think it was by any means a bad night for Aaron Regenberg, but, you know, it's so hard with eight people. It's so hard with eight people, right, to know how it's splitting up for everyone. That's how I feel.
Patrick, the debt limit is kind of an arcane issue for a lot of people. Have Regenberg's critics been effective in putting that into a narrative against him?
Maybe as effective as they could be, but as you said, this is not a kitchen table issue necessarily that's going to get people motivated. I mean, Gabe Amo probably had the best night in the recent debate, but I don't think he had the kind of night that was a direction changer of the race and structurally changed it. He tried the next day to keep things going and keep the attack on Regenberg's answer on the debt limit going. But I don't know that it's the kind of stumble that's going to really hurt Regenberg at this point. I think the dynamics of the race are pretty well set. And the fact that he has to explain himself, while it might not look good and while he is being ganged up on by all the other candidates, also doesn't look great. But it also reinforces that perception that he is the man to beat, that he is the front runner, and makes him not seem like an insurgent, but someone who has almost an incumbent quality.
Let's face it, the next member of Congress from the 1st District is going to be the least influential member of Congress fighting a years-long battle to be more influential due to a lack of seniority. Republicans hold the majority in the House right now. Patrick, does it really make much of a difference in the practical world of politics who wins this race on the Democratic side?
I think in the short term, in terms of things that voters will really notice, there aren't going to be a huge number of differences between what any of the candidates would do practically. I think for Regenberg, I think one thing to note is that he was fairly well-liked among lawmakers at the State House and is pretty good at the day-to-day meat and potatoes of lawmaking. So I don't think that he would struggle up there to work with people and would probably fit in quite easily. But he will add that extra, layer, I think, of attention to progressive causes that you wouldn't get to from the other candidates.
If I can jump in, Ian, I don't want to say the stakes are super high by any means, but I do think there is an interesting choice about to happen because, you know, Rhode Island's congressional delegation has historically been very congenial. Everyone follows Jack Reed's lead. You know, you can't get, even when Sheldon Whitehouse disagrees with Reed, I can barely get a quote out of him about it because he doesn't want to cross him. Aaron Regenberg is saying he wants to cut the budget for the military that Jack Reed writes, by $100 billion. So it's going to be really interesting if first district voters decide to put a more Elizabeth Warren, Ed Markey type of Democrat in. That will really be the first time that sort of Democrat is in Rhode Island's congressional delegation. So that will be a change, even if it's not exactly going to swing Capitol Hill dynamics.
Yeah, that's a great point, Ted. And of course, Regenberg has gotten endorsements from progressive darlings like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Ted, do you think Regenberg would go to the wall as a progressive if elected, potentially making him more vulnerable to a challenge next year if he does win this year? Or do you think he would moderate his course somewhat?
You know, I just think the power of incumbency for members of Congress, especially in the Northeast, is so enormous that I think Aaron Regenberg is probably more likely to draw a primary challenge, particularly next year if he wins next week, from people who say, hey, almost no one voted in that special election. Let's get back to a Jack Reed, Sheldon Whitehouse style Democrat in this seat. I still think he'd be an overwhelming favorite, even if one of the people currently running against him runs, because he will have the money that comes with incumbency, the profile that comes with it. And I've learned voters, I think a lot of voters feel that taking an office from someone is different from when it's open and you're firing someone. And that's a bigger hurdle for a lot of voters to go over. So I think whoever wins is going to be in very strong position from September 6th on. And we should say there'll be a Republican, of course, in the fall. But presuming the Democrats hold this seat, I think that Democrat will probably be in pretty strong no matter who it is.
One noteworthy element of the Democratic primary in CD1 is how the field includes a number of candidates who are women or people of color. Rhode Islanders, of course, have never elected a Democratic woman to Congress. Only Claudine Schneider, a Republican, was elected in the past. We know how Lieutenant Governor Sabina Matos, who was born in the Dominican Republic, was front runner early on, but has been dogged by a signature gathering controversy. Patrick, what is your sense of how the idea of electing someone other than just another white man affects the thinking of voters as they prepare to wrap up this race next week?
I don't know that it's powerful enough to swing the race. It's out there. I think there will be a weird sense if Aaron Regenberg wins that a progressive campaign prevented diversity from taking a step, and that's keeping the congressional delegation all white men. I think that will kind of linger and be there for at least the next couple of years. But I don't think that it's at this point it's front and center enough in the voters who will actually turn out to swing the race at this point.
I mean, not only that, if Aaron Regenberg does win, both of Rhode Island's House seats will be held by 30-something white men who went to Brown University and grew up upper middle class, who currently live on the east side because Magaziner just moved back temporarily. So that is quite, I mean, David Cicilline has said to people, hey, at least I was gay.
Let's talk a little bit about campaign finance. Of course, a lot of money has been spent on this race by the candidates and by outside groups, but there's not been a singularly memorable campaign ad like there was with Dan McKee in the race for governor last year when he had the ad playing cards with his mother that really humanized McKee. He spoke to the camera, came across well. It was a very effective ad. Patrick, your sense of the influence of advertising and money in this race?
I don't think it's really swung things. I think the ad that's gotten the most notoriety is Sandra Cano's, but I don't think that is the kind of memorable ad that's really going to stick. And I think one thing when I look at the advertising, Sabina Matos got a lot of help from the outside, but some of the people looking at the race have commented that it's not the same as having that money and having that power in your campaign. And she's been a little, while that has given her air cover, those outside groups, it's different than having that kind of money to use in your campaign for your own stuff.
Ted, as Patrick said, Sabina Matos has had about a 3-to-1 advantage or slightly more so in spending by outside super PACs. But it seems like she's just been dogged by relentless coverage of this signature issue. So your assessment of the campaign spending and advertising in the race?
I think two thoughts on that. The first one is, I think it's showing once again, we talk in campaign coverage about earned media, which is free news coverage, and paid media, where you're buying commercials or sending mailers. Very bad earned media is exponentially more powerful than a whole lot of paid media. That's what we see has happened to Sabina Matos. That signature scandal. And while I know some Democrats feel it was overblown, her campaign did lead to an ongoing criminal investigation because of what her vendor did. And so I think it's hard to minimize that was always going to be a big deal. The other thing is those, you know, one thing I've learned from my years in television, it's not just about the amount of airtime you buy. What are you showing in that airtime? And those super PAC ads were extremely generic. They were just like Sabina Matos, who never spoke, I think, in any of them. Sabina Matos, she's a Democrat. She supports abortion rights. They needed to reassess by the end of July. Sabina Matos is in trouble. We need to rebuild her standing. It doesn't feel like they ever did that.
Yeah, it kind of goes to my point how there hasn't been a single memorable ad that has stuck in the mind of voters. Ted, let's stick with you here. Another noteworthy thing about this race has been the lack of independent polling by media organizations. We know Brown University has kind of walked away from polling. And we've seen some internal polls from the campaigns, which have to be taken with a little bit of skepticism. But do you think this is a harbinger of what we'll see in the future, or Channel 12 has done a number of polls in the past? Do you think this is kind of an outlier?
I think it's partly an outlier. It's a special election. I'll be candid. It's harder as someone who works in a newsroom and with, you know, newsrooms all feeling a little tighter financially than we did 20 years ago, to argue for a poll that would be just serving Democratic primary special election voters. That means the poll, which is going to be expensive no matter what, we can't say it also told us something about how people feel about the Cranston Armory project or the approval rating of the governor. It would just be this one-time small electorate who's winning or losing. And I think it was just hard for media outlets at a time when there's a lot of different places we'd like to put the money to put it into that. That said, it is so difficult to cover a race like this with only internal polls. And we are kind of flying by the seat of our pants as reporters. So hopefully, you know, someone we haven't mentioned doesn't win and we all look like fools. But I think we do have a sense of where it stands.
Patrick, you and I did a debate or forum recently at RIPBS with the two Republicans running in CD1, Gary Leonard, longtime former Marine and former Middletown town councilor Terry Flynn. CD1 is heavily Democratic, so a Republican faces a real tough haul. What is your outlook for November?
Well, you want to talk about flying blind. We really have no idea what's going on in the Republican primary. I mean, the internal polls would be something we don't even have there. Who knows? And a very small number of voters are going to decide that. I mean, that said, I think Gary Leonard is clearly the favorite in the Republican primary, but faces a very difficult time once it gets to the general election. Maybe there's something he can do, especially if Aaron Regenberg is the candidate and there's a real distinction there, but it's a long shot.
All right. Great discussion. Thank you so much for joining me. The politics economics editor from WPRI-TV, Channel 12, Ted Nesi.
Glad to be here.
And State House reporter from the Providence Journal, Patrick Anderson.
Thank you, Ian.
The profile of former Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo remains on the rise. Raimondo traveled to China this week to meet with officials there about trade and related economic issues. The trip underscores how Raimondo has become a key point person for President Biden, and that's a long way from Gina from Smithfield. The U.S. relationship with China, one of the most important global relationships, is a work in progress. The same can be said about the future prospects of Raimondo, who is seen by some as a prospective presidential candidate in 2028. You can read more about that in my Friday TGIF column, posting around 4 this afternoon on what used to be known as Twitter, at Ian Don, and at thepublicsradio.org. That's our show for this week. Our producer is James Baumgartner. I'm Ian Donis, and I'll see you on the radio.